My pleasure to welcome out the stalwarts this morning. We'll be pleased to hear from three people comprising two honors program directors and two French scholars. Our first speaker will be Richard Cummings, who's director of the honors program at the University of Utah and professor of French. Second speaker is Richard Butler, who is a bookseller in Palo Alto, California, and is a student of French. And the respondent to their two papers will be Douglas Adler, who is also honors program director, but at Utah State University, and is professor of history. And we'll proceed as outlined on the printed program.
I didn't expect to have my ability to project tested to this degree. Those of you who don't realize that the speaker system isn't working may want to come down closer so we won't lose our voices halfway through our presentation. I'd like to just say a few things before I begin by saying that presenting this paper really is a source of great relief to me, simply because this topic for, I guess, about the past 2 years has become a kind of an obsession with me, and I need some catharsis. Literal-mindedness, I have noticed, is, as I see it, is so central to Mormonism that I expected, when it first occurred to me that this was the case, that I would find some studies on the subject. And I was both appalled and enthralled to find that there were none. And so I've been trying to put this thing together, and there is such an abundance of material to choose from that I've had some difficulty in actually selecting the things that I think make the point most effectively. I have to admit that I've had to be very arbitrary, and there are a number of areas of this particular topic that I think need to be addressed by other people. I think it's too rich in a certain sense to be entrusted to any one person's insights. And I would suggest that the three areas that I think I'd like to see someone consider eventually would be the impact of literal-mindedness on theology in the Mormon Church. The impact on symbology would be another, and the impact on humor would be a third area. To the extent, I think, that one is literal-minded, it's very difficult to stand back far enough to see what is humorous, to really grasp in its totality the theology, and also symbolism becomes a little bit simplified as a result of this. All right, the title of my address is Quintessential Mormonism, Literal-Mindedness as a Way of Life. No single feature of Mormonism strikes many perceptive non-Mormon observers with greater force than Mormon literal-mindedness. For instance, in his monumental and largely sympathetic monograph, The Mormons, published in 1957, Thomas F. O'Day wrote that, quote, literalism became and largely remained characteristic of the Mormon approach to modern revelation. He went on to add that Mormonism is a very literalistic kind of religion on the whole, basing its claims to divinity and veracity upon the status of its revelations and their literal meaning, close quote. Another outside commentator, Ernst W. Benz, professor emeritus of church history at the University of Marburg, observed in 1978 that, quote, in no other Christian doctrine is the idea of man as the image of God so concretely and literally interpreted as in Mormonism, close quote. Similarly, serious Mormon scholars whose secular studies enable them to see the Mormon belief system in a broader historical and ideological perspective become acutely aware of the peculiarly literalistic bent of Mormonism. In this connection, Sterling M. McMurrin points out that, quote, the intellectual foundations of Mormonism are compatible with its biblical literalism, close quote. Richard D. Paul describes the mainstream Mormon as an iron rod member who finds all the answers in the standard works because, quote, he accepts them as God's word in a literal sense, close quote. And more recently, Richard Sherlock discussed at some length the considerable influence of Joseph Fielding Smith's, quote, defense of an extreme literalism on the church's official doctrinal interpretations. In point of fact, no one from within the Mormon community or without can presume to fathom the peculiar worldview of Mormonism without taking into account the literalism of its premises. And I shall attempt to demonstrate in specific ways how and why this is so. Let me begin with some useful definitions. I use literalism and literal-mindedness as basically synonymous descriptions of a distinct mindset which presumes facticity in scriptural accounts, interprets scripture at face value, and, by extension, tends to favor one-to-one equivalence over ambiguous multivalence, a reductive simplicity over abstract complexity, the concrete over the speculative, the categorical over the tentative, and finally, the palpably material over the vaguely spiritual. Moreover, I would like to distinguish four different kinds of literalism. First, there is doctrinal or ideological literalism on the one hand, and ecclesiastical or institutional literalism on the other. By doctrinal literalism, I am referring to a belief system based on a literalistic interpretation of divine revelations in ancient and modern scripture, as well as recent doctrinal pronouncements by church leaders. By ecclesiastical literalism, I mean the tendency to perceive rules of conduct and procedural directives as absolutely binding and letter perfect in their official formulation, with minimal latitude for individual interpretation. I would also like to distinguish between creative literalism and defensive literalism. The former is an open, implemental literalism which affords new insights and challenges old ways of thinking, whereas the latter is, by definition, more closed, fearful of new, untried points of view, and cultivates literalism for its own sake. The supreme instance of Mormon literalism, which is at once the cornerstone of Mormon belief, the sine qua non of an Orthodox testimony, and the prototype, if not the fountainhead, of many literal beliefs which were to follow, was Joseph Smith's first vision. This experience is accepted literally by most Mormons as the greatest event that has ever occurred in the world since the resurrection of the Son of God. I'm quoting from Joseph F. Smith. By his own account, as a puzzled 14-year-old, Joseph Smith took literally the words of James: "If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God that giveth to all men liberally and upbraideth not, and it shall be given him." Again, by his own account, he concluded that he must either remain in darkness and confusion, or do as James directs, that is, ask of God. And the response to his prayer turned out to be one of the most powerful manifestations of deity to be found anywhere. As he relates it, not only did God the Father appear to him, but also Jesus Christ, both apparently in glorified physical form as distinct personages. The full doctrinal significance of this epiphany was not enunciated by Joseph Smith until the end of his career, notably in the King Follett Discourse, which he delivered in April 1844, and in which he declared that God is literally an exalted man, and that men are the literal offspring of God. Surely, in the entire Judeo-Christian tradition, there has been no more literal interpretation than that of the basic doctrine set forth in Genesis 2:27, that God created man in his own image. This initial encounter between Joseph Smith and two very concrete and discrete members of the Godhead set the stage for a series of remarkable events, each as literalistic as the first, which heralded or implemented the founding of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which Joseph Smith declared to be an actual restoration, an exact replica of the original church established by Christ during his earthly ministry. There were other significant and literal events as related by Joseph Smith. The appearance of the angel Moroni, who revealed the whereabouts of engraved gold plates, and the Urim and Thummim, which Joseph Smith used to translate the engravings as the Book of Mormon. The appearance of the resurrected John the Baptist, who personally baptized Joseph Smith and his amanuensis Oliver Cowdery, and conferred upon them the Aaronic priesthood by the laying on of hands. The appearance of the resurrected apostles Peter, James, and John, who conferred upon Joseph Smith the keys of the Melchizedek priesthood by a physical laying on of hands. Finally, a steady flow of revelations which Joseph Smith received directly from on high and which were presented to the membership and received by them as the literal word of God, all the more so because the vast majority were prefaced by "Thus saith the Lord" and were expressed in the deific first person singular. This unprecedented sequence of events left in its wake a series of starkly literalistic doctrines, some positively electrifying, others mind-boggling in the way in which they seem to defy traditional theological good taste, others merely quaint, and all logical concomitants of Joseph Smith's first vision. Probably the most exciting of these literal theological outgrowths of Joseph Smith's seminal encounter with the divine was the doctrine of eternal progression, which draws the logical conclusion that since God is an exalted man and the spirits of men were sired by God, then men and women have the potential of evolving literally into gods themselves. It also follows that salvation consists not in seeking the traditional stasis of the beatific vision, but rather in achieving a dynamic transformation into divine kings and queens, literally reaching the exalted status of world-peopling gods and goddesses who will function in their celestial kingdoms just as do the divine beings who rule over the world of our experience. Carrying the implications of this doctrine of exaltation one step further along the patriarchal lines which Joseph Smith encountered in the Old Testament leads inevitably to the doctrine of plural marriage. Since procreation on such a cosmic scale cannot be limited to a single deified couple, but necessitates an array of heavenly wives for each fully evolved god. A noteworthy byproduct of this line of theologizing is the belief that Jesus Christ was not begotten by the Holy Ghost, as maintained by traditional Christianity, but, as Bruce R. McConkie puts it, quote, Christ was begotten by an immortal father in the same way that mortal men are begotten by mortal fathers, close quote. In other words, by the literal physical union of God and Mary. Although I know of no more striking example of Mormon literalism than the anthropocentric sexual implications of the doctrine of eternal progression, I would like to mention two other representative instances of doctrinal literalism before turning to institutional literalism. First, let us examine briefly the 10th article of faith. It begins, "We believe in the literal gathering of Israel and in the restoration of the 10 tribes." Although the other articles imply literal belief, this is the only one of the 13 which explicitly includes the term literal. It is significant not only because it suggests that Joseph Smith was himself aware of the extreme literalism of much of what he said, but also because it calls specific attention to the very literal importance which he attached to lineage, and more specifically to patriarchal bloodlines. This in turn leads to the fascinating topic of blood literalism, only two aspects of which will be touched upon here, namely literal adoption into the house of Israel through the process of conversion and the literalistic aspects of the doctrine of blood atonement. Joseph Smith taught that anyone converting to Mormonism, though of completely Gentile lineage, was not only adopted into the house of Israel, but also underwent a remarkable change, the effect of which was, quote, to purge out the old blood and make the convert actually of the seed of Abraham, close quote. In other words, not only does the convert experience a spiritual transformation, but he or she also undergoes a miraculous physical change whereby his or her blood is literally transmuted from Gentile blood to the blood of Israel. It's like changing type A to type B in some miraculous fashion, literally. The doctrine of blood atonement has had a checkered career which by itself could provide a rewarding study of the vagaries of Mormon literalism. Unfortunately, the doctrine appears to be the result of an overly literal interpretation and elaboration of certain scriptures, such as Hebrews 9:22, which states that, quote, almost all things are by the law purged with blood, and without shedding of blood is no remission, close quote. Accordingly, the doctrine asserts that those who commit certain grievous sins, such as murder and covenant breaking, place themselves beyond the atoning blood of Christ, and their only hope for salvation is to have their own blood shed as an atoning sacrifice. In his writings, Joseph Smith only hinted at the doctrine. Brigham Young successively denied and asserted it. Joseph F. Smith ardently defended it. And in more recent years, Hugh B. Brown repudiated it. And Joseph Fielding Smith and Bruce R. McConkie both have vigorously defended it in principle, while staunchly denying that the church has ever put it into actual practice, whereas most other general authorities have prudently preferred to remain silent on the subject. It should be noted that the whole notion of blood atonement is so obviously linked to the Mormon literal mindset that it does not seem to admit of a mitigated symbolic interpretation, and is either accepted or rejected outright, depending on one's level of literalistic belief. The main point of these allusions to the role of blood in Mormon doctrine is the total absence of any figurative level of meaning. Blood literally changes in the veins of the truly faithful, and the blood of the despicably unfaithful must literally be shed on their own behalf. Although I could go on indefinitely citing such instances of literal mindedness, time restrictions have necessitated a limited but representative choice of examples, which I hope have nevertheless amply demonstrated the quintessential role of literalism in Mormon thought and belief. I would also like to emphasize that I am convinced that the strongly literal imprint which Joseph Smith left on Mormonism was basically positive, all the more so because the facility with which it enabled him to resolve time-worn theological controversies provided welcome relief from the tired efforts of generations of contending churchmen to rationalize doctrinal inconsistencies with elaborate arguments and figures of speech. Regrettably, in religious circles, there has always been a tendency to out-pope the Pope, and in the framework of Mormonism, no more striking example of this can be found than the way in which so many of Joseph Smith's followers have sought to outdo the prophet himself in the pursuit of literalism, a trend which has led to many doctrinal distortions and ecclesiastical abuses. One of the most poignant examples of ecclesiastical literalism occurred in 1857, and because it led to one of the greatest tragedies in the history of the church, and can also be regarded as a further example of blood literalism and as a paradigmatic instance of institutional literalism, I would like to relate it in some detail. It concerns William H. Dame, a 35-year-old, kindly, mild-mannered Latter-day Saint living in southern Utah, who had been appointed colonel by Brigham Young and put in command of the entire Iron County Militia. In 1854, he had received his patriarchal blessing from Patriarch Elisha Groves in Parowan. It's important to note this was in 1854, 3 years before the time I'm calling your attention to. In 1854, he had received his patriarchal blessing from Patriarch Elisha Groves in Parowan, the concluding paragraph of which reads as follows, and I quote, "Thou shalt be called to act at the head of a portion of thy brethren and of the Lamanites in the redemption of Zion and the avenging of the blood of the prophets. The angel of vengeance shall be with thee, shall nerve and strengthen thee. Like unto Moroni, no power shall be able to stand before thee until thou hast accomplished thy work." Close quote. Colonel Dame found himself in an awkward position in late August 1857 because of the strong antagonism which the Mormon community felt at the outset of the Utah War toward a group of emigrants camped 35 miles southwest of Cedar City on the California Trail. The party was made up of several families from Arkansas and a band of horsemen known as the Missouri Wildcats, some of whom had boasted openly of having participated in the murder of Joseph and Hiram Smith at Carthage 13 years earlier. Dame was caught in a crossfire of demands by local Indians to join in a raid on the emigrants and mixed signals from local Mormon settlers, some of whom demanded revenge, while others strove to keep matters from getting out of hand. Worst of all, there was not time enough to obtain guidance from secular and ecclesiastical headquarters in Salt Lake City. So, under pressure from the local ecclesiastical authority, Stake President Isaac Haight, who demanded official orders, and eager to prevent any further friction between the Indians and the Mormons, Colonel Dame clearly fell back on a literal interpretation of his patriarchal blessing, especially with respect to the avenging of the blood of the prophets and the assurance that the angel of vengeance shall nerve and strengthen thee. In issuing the order to John D. Lee, which, through a chain of literal-minded obedience to literally conceived orders, led directly to the Mountain Meadows Massacre, in which some 120 emigrants, including men, women, and older children, were brutally murdered by a combined force of Indians and Mormon militiamen. William Dame had ample opportunity to wreak the whirlwind of his literalism. According to John D. Lee, Dame rode to the site of the massacre and contemplated with horror the contorted bodies of the dead. He then said to Isaac Haight, "I did not think there were so many of them, or I would not have had anything to do with it." Haight replied, "That makes no difference. You ordered me to do it, and you've got to stand by your orders." I have deliberately chosen a rather lurid example of institutional literalism, not only because it is representative of the genre, since it embodies literalism of intent and a very literal interpretation and implementation, but more especially because it exemplifies the kind of extremism which so often characterizes literal-mindedness and which, in my opinion, constitutes the most serious danger implicit in excessive literal-mindedness. I am concerned about this phenomenon not merely as a historical fact, but as a contemporary reality. The marked swing toward political and ideological conservatism, which have characterized the church since the early 70s, have created a climate which is almost as favorable to institutional liberalism as was the garrison mentality of the church during much of the latter half of the 19th century, when political opposition and national unpopularity justified such a mentality. Recent pronouncements by church authorities, such as Elaine Cannon's statement in 1978 that when the prophet speaks, the debate is over, and Ezra Taft Benson's declaration in 1979 that the living prophet's utterances take precedence over those of his deceased predecessors and should be regarded by the membership as literal marching orders, would indicate that institutional literalism is indeed alive and well in the church today. In this connection, it is significant that as recently as last year, a perspicacious non-Mormon scholar, Edwin S. Gousted, professor of religious studies at the University of California at Riverside, warned of the devastating effects on Mormon historiography if, quote, obscurantism and mindless literalism assume control, close quote. I've already indicated that Joseph Smith realized how literal his teachings were, and he also seemed to foresee the dangers inherent in the potential abuses of institutional literalism, for he made periodic statements warning against such abuses, notably when in 1834 he defended the notion that, quote, all men have the privilege of thinking for themselves, and again in 1839 when he warned that all men are disposed, as soon as they get a little authority, to begin to exercise unrighteous dominion, close quote. Probably the greatest single benefit derived from the exercise of institutional literalism is efficiency. And even the church's most vitriolic detractors grudgingly admit that the church is a paragon of administrative virtue. But in one's zeal to follow orders as literally as possible, some attention should be paid to the broader context into which literal-minded obedience fits. For nothing could have been more efficient or more horrifying than the Mountain Meadows Massacre, in which, as Juanita Brooks relates, quote, everything went according to the plan, and all accounts agree that it was quickly over, close quote. Occasionally, intellectuals, men of some learning, like Orson Pratt, were converted to Mormonism, or else, like B.H. Roberts, James E. Talmage, and John A. Widsoe, they developed in a Mormon setting. And they caught the full vision of the broader implications of Mormon belief, far beyond the limited literalism of the rank and file. These learned latitudinarians, who could see the scientific and philosophical implications of Mormon doctrine, provided a healthy counterbalance to those who, even at the highest levels of leadership, were more comfortable limiting their religious beliefs and activities to narrower, more literally oriented, and more immediately productive channels. Since the passing of John A. Widsoe in 1952, and even more emphatically since the demise of Hubie Brown in 1978, Mormon officialdom has come full circle from the naive, open literalism of the 14-year-old Joseph Smith to the church's present-day homogeneous and homogenizing official literal-mindedness, which fosters blind obedience by discouraging independent thought and all forms of criticism, however honest or constructive. It is significant that until his death in 1952, Elder Widsoe, who before being called to the Council of the Twelve had been a university president and a renowned scholar in his own right, occupied the position of de facto theologian for the church because of his widely acclaimed series of articles, Evidences and Reconciliations, in which he provided balanced, carefully reasoned answers to probing queries about the gospel. It is equally significant that whether by default or design, his successor was Joseph Fielding Smith, who renamed the series Answers to Gospel Questions and proceeded to provide literal replies in which the citing of scriptures and categorical pronouncements took the place of the more scholarly reasoning of Dr. Widsoe. Finally, it would appear that more by default than by design, Elder Smith's son-in-law, Bruce R. McConkie, who published in 1966 an alphabetized catalog of doctrinal statements entitled Mormon Doctrine, has succeeded to the unofficial title of resident Mormon theologian. I cite this threefold succession because it says much about the current role of literalism in the church. To be more specific, I will quote from these three successive doctrinal authorities on the theory of organic evolution. Elder Widsoe, who was both a scientist and a general authority, took 8 pages to answer the question, to what extent should the doctrine of evolution be accepted? In the course of his discussion, he quotes extensively from scientists and philosophers, as well as mentioning pertinent scriptures, and he concludes as follows, quote, the law of evolution or change may be accepted fully. It is nothing more or less than the gospel law of progress, or its opposite. The theory of evolution, which may contain practical truth, should be looked upon as one of the changing hypotheses of science. Man's explanation of a multitude of observed facts. It would be folly to make it the foundation of a life's philosophy. End of quote. Elder Widsoe clearly sees some practical value in the theory of evolution, seeks to reconcile Mormonism and science as much as possible, but ultimately makes it clear that revealed truth must take precedence over the theories of men. In marked contrast, Joseph Fielding Smith, who once said that broad-mindedness is of the devil, adopts a literalistic stance in dismissing the theory of evolution. Quote, "The idea that everything commenced from a small beginning and has gradually developed until all forms of life have all sprung from one source is falsehood absolutely. There is no truth in it, for God has given us his word by which we may know the truth of these things." End of quote. Elsewhere he says, quote, "Naturally, since I believe in modern revelation, I cannot accept these so-called scientific teachings, for I believe them to be in conflict with the simple and direct word of the Lord that has come to us by divine revelation." Obviously, only by accepting the simple word of the Lord literally is it possible to adopt such a position. Finally, Elder McConkie, in the 1979 edition of his Mormon Doctrine, in a 10-page entry entitled Evolution, uncompromisingly condemns every aspect of the theory of organic evolution, quoting extensively from his father-in-law's Origin and Destiny of Man, and he summarizes his findings by stating, quote, "How weak and puerile the intellectuality which, knowing that the Lord's plan takes all forms of life from a pre-existent spirit state through mortality and on to an ultimate resurrected state of immortality, yet finds comfort in the theoretical postulates that mortal life began in the scum of the sea, as it were, and has through eons of time evolved to its present varieties and state." He then concludes with the italicized pronouncement that there is no harmony between the truths of revealed religion and the theories of organic evolution. One has the feeling of a little bit of overkill in the way in which things are italicized and so on. But anyhow, he makes his point. He certainly makes his point. This resurgence of defensive literalism clashes jarringly with the basic Mormon precept that the glory of God is intelligence, and with the admonition set forth in Doctrine and Covenants 88:118, urging the faithful to seek out of the best books words of wisdom. Seek learning even by studying and also by faith. It puts a tremendous strain on well-educated Latter-day Saints who seek to reconcile the words of wisdom they have found studying the best books with the injunction to interpret and practice their religion as literally as possible. This strain often becomes especially intense during fast and testimony meetings when members tend to try to outdo each other in the degree of literalism which their powers of belief have attained. Perhaps the greatest disservice which defensive literalism can do to the church is to foster the illusion that the entire Mormon enterprise is a kind of divinely sanctioned, seamless whole. That, for instance, the Book of Mormon was originally translated so perfectly that not one change has been made in it. I don't know how many times I was told that in Sunday school and primary and mutual, wherever. Or that all utterances of all church leaders are divinely inspired. Or that all the doctrines of the church are perfectly understandable and consistent with each other, and that there is no room for the slightest controversy. This is generally the very illusion which officially correlated materials, especially manuals of religious instruction, tend to produce. And the impact on thinking members can be devastating. Ultimately, this trend leads to a dichotomous extremism characterized on the one hand by a kind of neo-Tertullianism on the part of those who choose to remain in the fold, professing a literalistic credo qui absurdum est, I believe because it is absurd. And on the other hand, it can lead the disillusioned to abandon the church in favor of one form or another of Tannerism, the temptation to follow the example of Gerald and Sandra Tanner's single-minded career of systematic denunciation of alleged inconsistencies in the church. If the breathtaking directness of certain creatively literal doctrines, such as man's potential to become a god, account in large measure for the dramatic proselyting successes of the church, then conversely, it is because of the stiflingly defensive literal-mindedness of much of the leadership that so many well-educated second or third generation Mormons find it so difficult to remain in good conscience within the fold of contemporary orthodoxy. In conclusion, I would like to emphasize that literalism of the most creative sort is an exciting and a very positive part of our Mormon heritage, especially as it relates to the mainstream of Mormon history. And I would like to mention a few of the highlights. We have already noted that Joseph Smith began his religious career as an unschooled youth in 1820 in the most naively literal-minded terms, which in retrospect proved to be an incredibly creative literalism, considering the refreshing novelty of his religious views and the irresistible attraction which his message had for many converts. The basic literalism of his teachings tended to appeal in very literal terms to the relatively uneducated. Then, as he studied and reflected on the implications of all that his spiritual sources revealed to him, he saw things in ever-broadening perspectives and sought to bring them into more meaningful alignment with each other through the use of increasingly figurative language and such metaphorical allusions as the image of the ladder of progression and the ring of eternal existence in the King Follett discourse. Those converted at any particular time tended to focus on the main points of doctrine which had been emphasized up to that point. Those who seized too readily on literal fundamentals without catching the broader vistas and higher meanings that Joseph Smith himself sought out and valued so much tended to become disaffected or break off into splinter groups. Brigham Young took literally Joseph Smith's prediction that the saints would relocate in the Rocky Mountains, and in bringing that prophecy to pass, he became the Moses of the New World at the head of a monumental exodus, the fruits of which we proudly extol, all the more so because it could not have been accomplished without the dedicated personal sacrifice of our pioneer forebears who were willing to obey their leaders to the letter. Heber J. Grant took literally Brigham Young's preaching on the need for Zion to achieve economic self-sufficiency and thereby save the church from financial disaster in the Panic of 1893. And with admirable skill and dedication, he continued to consolidate and augment the church's assets during his presidency. David O. McKay took literally the Savior's injunction to love our neighbor as ourselves, and as president of the church, ushered in an era of unprecedented goodwill in promoting family love and in fostering friendly relations with other churches and with a wide range of non-members. Harold B. Lee took literally Christ's admonition to care for the needy and afflicted when he developed the church welfare plan. And more recently, President Spencer W. Kimball took literally the precept of Joseph Smith that salvation and even exaltation are ultimately available to all of mankind when, in 1978, he sought and received a revelation authorizing the granting of the priesthood to the black race. However, even though the intrinsic literalism of the Mormon religion has, for the most part, been channeled in positive, creative ways, we have clearly seen that there are many dangers lurking in the natural inclination to exaggerate or misuse that same literalism along narrowly defensive and even manipulative lines. In the Lord's Prayer, we are enjoined to ask the Lord not to lead us into temptation. If for Catholics, that temptation lies in excessive reliance on tradition, and for Protestants, it takes the form of overemphasizing the role of individual conscience, then for Mormons, it seems to me that the great temptation, which every faithful Latter-day Saint, and especially those in positions of authority, should resist with every fiber of their being, is to carry to absurd and damaging extremes the literalism which lies at the core of the Mormon belief system. If, as this paper has set out to demonstrate, Mormonism is the most literal-minded of religions, then Paul's words in 2 Corinthians 3:6 have very special meaning and a strong note of warning for all Latter-day Saints. Quote, "Our sufficiency is of God, who also hath made us ministers of the New Testament, not of the letter, but of the Spirit. For the letter killeth, but the Spirit giveth life." Thank you.
Kim pointed out several parallels today, and I would note several more. I was struck recently by the similarity in an article published in Sunstone by Bonner Ritchie. Some of the parallels between the things that I had been dealing with in the paper that I'm about to read to you, and then subsequent to that, Peggy mentioned that she had paired my paper with Dr. Cummings and said she thought that they would fit well together, and I am again stunned by the similarity of the ideas, although in each of the three cases we're approaching it from rather different perspectives. As you know, the title of this paper is Shadow Authority, and I'll begin by reading an epigraph to the paper, which is taken from the 121st section of the Doctrine and Covenants. "Because their hearts are set so much upon the things of this world and aspire to the honors of men, that they do not learn this one lesson. All humans and societies share a common paradox. Two opposing but complementary needs shape the choices and orientations of people and their institutions: community and independence. The function of authority in human institutions is to enforce among members of societies estimable behavior and values. Unfortunately, the forces of human authority seem inevitably to shift focus away from the values they purport to empower and toward self-institutionalization. The Lord has confirmed the operation of authority within the church, suggesting as rationale the need for a house of order. It has, however, an additional and far more significant function than simply to assure cohesion and unity. LDS ecclesiastical authority serves most importantly as the channel of saving knowledge, for it is through well-defined hierarchy that the broad outlines of the gospel are passed to church members. However, because it acts as the vehicle of revealed direction, church governmental structure has become invested with immense moral power of its own. Because of priesthood's divine source and its association with principles and ordinances of salvation, the human ecclesiastical structure through which it functions is largely immune to challenge. As a result, authoritative dicta and structures in LDS society are stronger and more persuasive than in society generally. Further, most church members appear willing to extend the same disciplined respect readily and without question to any authority, whatever its origin. Consequently, in Mormon culture, human and divine authority sources intertwine. Distinctions blur and disappear. Ultimately, authority rooted in social and cultural imperatives assumes the value and power of divine origin. The tension between institutional authority and individual agency is the overriding theological and practical dilemma of Mormonism and is responsible for its spiritual vitality. It is clear both from an overview of the gospel plan as well as from specific scriptures that both elements are essential to successful and fulfilling life. Each person is unique and must live according to that most basic fact. Yet obedience to gospel principles is necessarily counterposed against personal autonomy. Indeed, one cannot achieve her or his unique and utmost flowering without willing and humble submission to what is, in one sense, an alien will. But priesthood, righteously exercised, is as protective of individual will as of the requirements of personal discipline exemplified in expectations of the institutional church. Though the tension between these poles is a necessary and desirable aspect of gospel living, it can be counterproductive or destructive if either of its elements is overemphasized. The recent high-paced increase in the rate of conversions has brought bureaucracy and standardization to the church. More significantly, it has brought pressures to institutionalize application of the gospel in personal living. The organizational effects of rapid growth have been considered in some depth. But the LDS correlation approach to the relatively sudden birth of an organization with millions of members has had more subtle, yet wider-ranging human ramifications which appear to have been ignored. Generally speaking, this has taught Latter-day Saints to expect paternalism from their church and strict homogeneity from each other. Specifically, the following manifestations have developed. First, thoughtless and automatic acquiescence without regard to accuracy or source whenever authority is invoked. Second, clouded distinctions and stigmatization of discretion exercised with regard to authority. And third, widening and intensification of the focus of hierarchical authority and parallel acceptance of the notion that authority is its own justification. The net result of such trends has been overemphasis of the role and distortion of the nature of legitimate ecclesiastical authority. Over the pulpit in priesthood meeting in a California ward in spring 1980, the bishop presented for signatures a petition requesting that the Secretary of State place on the upcoming ballot a measure to restrict smoking in public places throughout the state. He encouraged qualified voters to sign it and specifically assigned quorum presidents to circulate copies for signature in their quorums. When it was suggested that the issue lay outside the bounds of his stewardship, he maintained that the question was not political, but doctrinal, and rejected reasoning which called into question his judgment on the nature of the issue or his right to make such judgments. Underlying such conflicts as this is confusion of temporal and divine authorities. Such confusion has done much both to secularize the gospel and to extend the scope and power of hierarchical influence beyond its proper bounds. The situation described above illustrates the concurrent operation in Mormon society of two distinct sorts of authority. One is the legitimate influence of priesthood, which fosters unity and encourages application of gospel principles within the church community. The other is an augmented and distorted shadow of the gently persuasive and clearly focused authority of true priesthood, a shadow which derives from prejudice, insecurity, and thoughtlessness. Shadow authority is secularly derived authority passed through church hierarchical channels, thus endowed with the aspect of priesthood authority and empowered by attribution as it is accorded the respect and obedience due priesthood. It is the pressure which enforces demands made on church members to fulfill personal, social, or cultural expectations couched as doctrine or revealed direction. A product of the narrowly focused moral influence of the priesthood, magnified and diffused, shadow authority exists in an atmosphere where sociocultural convictions and spiritual convictions are not distinguished. In Book of Mormon times, Mosiah, Alma, and Helaman bemoaned false teachings passed from generation to generation among the Lamanites. Modern Latter-day Saint society has developed the same syndrome, adopting worldly attitudes and transmitting them thoughtlessly as eternal truth. Church members have been sufficiently attracted to secular ways that they are willing to misuse priesthood in order to enforce observance of such foolish traditions. Saints have directed priesthood to unrighteous ends by widening its scope and diluting its influence with secular authority to create a counterfeit force which rules by threat of ostracism. In varying degrees across the church, members presently find themselves susceptible in almost every aspect of life to manipulation by means of shadow authority, either by imputation, when Latter-day Saints impose sociocultural expectations on each other, by attributing their perceptions to authoritative sources, or by fiat, when those in hierarchical office convey as doctrine or priesthood direction personal biases in matters outside the appropriate range of ecclesiastical authority. Until recently, the extent of shadow authority's influence has, ironically, paralleled growth of the church. This has been so because in areas where the gospel message has traditionally had greatest exposure and found widest acceptance, significant parallels with Western American culture have facilitated operation of shadow authority and have in fact strengthened it. By this process, shadow authority has catalyzed development of a large body of non-doctrinal, culturally derived beliefs and practices accepted by many as part of the gospel. Presently, however, the ramifications of cross-cultural missionary work and church administration throw into sharp relief the conflict between shadow authority and true priesthood. It will not much longer be possible to ignore the specter of hollow authoritarianism embodied in cultural chauvinism practiced in the church at both local and international levels. Though the California incident described above is flagrant, it is nonetheless typical of daily occurrences throughout the church in which personal choice and taste are similarly constricted and channeled by a power which operates through priesthood office, but which has no connection with priesthood itself. This occurs in facets of life as diverse as gender roles and family structure, social relations, occupation, education, values, and doctrine. The following brief examples illustrate the range of sociocultural judgments consistently enforced in the church by shadow authority. A bishop counsels a newly married elder about proper roles in an LDS marriage, explaining that women prefer to be protected from all non-domestic cares and to have important decisions made for them, that indeed the Lord intends it so, The elder is told by his priesthood leader that he must ensure that his marriage conforms to this ideal. An LDS couple sees appointment in rapid succession of a series of home teachers, each of whom attempts to steer the husband into more lucrative occupation on the evident assumption that since the wife earns several times his salary, the couple is childless by economic necessity. Nationally prominent Mormons, whose business and entertainment practices are in clear contradiction of certain gospel principles, receive praise and official recognition from church leaders. Missionaries tell Nigerian saints that the LDS hymnal is scripture, and that indigenous music is therefore inappropriate in local church services. A general authority writes a compendium of purported doctrinal summaries, publishing strictly speculative ideas on at least one subject as eternal truth. When these speculations are shown to be such by subsequent revelation, there is no apparent recognition that many church members have believed and taught false doctrine over a period of some 25 years simply because it came from one in lofty hierarchical office. Though details differ, all instances of the exercise of shadow authority suggest the same questions. First, whether church hierarchy properly has discretion over a given subject. Second, what criteria can be used to make that determination? And third, how improper assumption of such discretion can be challenged. The underlying problem here is to define the limits of priesthood authority. The key to delimiting valid LDS ecclesiastical power lies in tracing invoked authority to its source each time it is invoked. Weakened by the facility of their life, and blinded by the flattery of the world, saints of the present generally neglect the effort to distinguish among a range of authorities. It is essential that church members strive consistently to discover the nature and source of authority in order to determine its worthiness of commitment and loyalty. Neither authority nor obedience is of use to a Latter-day Saint without personal knowledge of its validity and value. A major stumbling block is the fact that the church has a vague and imprecise notion of the nature of priesthood. It is referred to only in the most abstract and cliched terms among the general membership of the church, while doctrinal sources and commentaries seldom, if ever, come to the point of defining it concretely. John Taylor provides the following typical phraseology, quote, "Priesthood is the government of God. It is by that power, agency, or principle that all things are governed on the earth and in the heavens, and by that power that all things are upheld and sustained." If, for purposes of this earthly context, priesthood is simply authority to act in God's name, then Latter-day Saints lack not only a clear concept of its proper role and function, but more especially a sense of measure and self-awareness in exercising it. Several semantic distinctions would foster perception of the proper scope of legitimate church authority. The church would benefit by more careful use of the term priesthood. This word, which can refer to three or four different functions, is seldom used with any precision. Latter-day Saints should try to differentiate between priesthood and authority with its more secular connotations. Artificial as this may seem, if church members would think of priesthood less as power to direct people and more as obligation to serve and bless them, the likely result would be an analogous change in attitude and practice. Another helpful distinction would separate the concept of government from that of hierarchy. Significantly, in the passage cited above, John Taylor discusses government with no suggestion that it implies imposition of a hierarchy. Use of more precise language would encourage Latter-day Saints toward more frequent and careful consideration of underlying assumptions about priesthood. In modern revelation, the Lord has warned that exercise of the authority conferred on priesthood holders has strict limits, and that the power inherent in priesthood office can and has influenced some to expand the influence of priesthood beyond these limits. Indeed, genuine priesthood authority is severely limited in the concerns to which it can rightfully and righteously turn its attention. The Lord has further specifically cautioned that power, even priesthood power, corrupts. He has stated that his delegated authority is neither an end in itself, nor power to compel, nor arbitrary justification for the exercise of power. That, of course, is D&C 121. At least one of these forms of unrighteous dominion characterizes all manifestations of shadow authority. Most examples of it evince all three. When is authority exercised in Mormon society appropriately given respect and obedience due divine direction? In what circumstances is priesthood influence properly used? John Widsoe formulates the question in this way: shall a man obey a man? In reply, he makes the following three points. Quote, the first consideration is whether the system which the man in authority represents, The first consideration is whether the system which the man in authority represents is based on truth. The second consideration is whether the man who, unless a member of the First Presidency, has limited jurisdiction, is acting within his authority in the organization. The third consideration is whether the matter to which authority has been applied is at all under the discipline of the organization. No officer in the church has authority beyond matters pertaining to the church. Authority exercised beyond that field is accepted only at the discretion of individual members of the church and should come only as counsel. Unquote. Widsoe's second and third considerations give substance to the limitations noted in section 121. They raise questions which undergird the distinction between shadow authority and legitimate authority. Careful analysis and discrimination are required to see clearly in such questions. An attitude of constant testing and validation underlies Widsoe's criteria. But such an attitude gives rise to the same essential tension noted earlier. Unfortunately, many in the church fear this tension, and for that reason refuse to accept the necessity of making the distinctions inherent in Widsoe's points. The power of saving knowledge has accrued to church hierarchy to the ironic extent that hierarchy often appears to legitimize the guidance it conveys rather than the opposite. This has made it as important to distinguish between divine and secular sources of authority as to discriminate between true and false principles. As shadow authority has grown in strength and scope, the delicate agency-authority balance has become difficult, for some impossible, to achieve or sustain. In order to restore this equilibrium in the church, it is essential that Latter-day Saints purify their perception of the gospel, that they seek verification of absolutes independently of the context of cultural Mormonism. For institutional reasons, as well as for intensely personal ones, it is essential that church members accept distinctions among types of authority operative in LDS society and that they adhere to the ramifications of such distinctions. In order to do so, they must be willing to recognize the kinds of sociocultural authority which enforce foolish traditions and to discover the meaning of priesthood and the proper scope of church hierarchical authority. Church members must adopt the attitude of the first Latter-day Saints, whose spiritual unity was defined not by common cultural or societal values, but by conscious commitment to the source of that authority to which they gave allegiance, who indeed rejected, at great cost, many sorts of secular authority in order to do so. If the church is to succeed in saving souls unto perfection, both the institutional church and individual members must accept such an approach as basic to implementation of absolutes in a heterogeneous world, rejecting the attraction of particular cultures and social structures, and more especially the power of shadow authority, which enforces conformity to such secular systems by counterfeiting true priesthood. Thank you.
During the readings of these papers, I have almost wanted to stand up and bear my testimony. And the testimony I want to bear is of the glory of the Academy, of the importance of dialogue, of criticism, of discussion, and yet much of what I may say now, you will interpret to say how unimportant the Academy may in fact be. I'm pleased to respond to these two men, both of whom I know and love. They have brought to us really, terribly meaty issues. I'm sure there's no one in the room who hasn't spent many a daydreaming hour or even writing in journals or anguishing or suffering over these real issues. My concern, though, about these papers and about this meeting, about me and you, is the sacredness of the responsibility we have as critics in society. Society needs critics badly. It's a luxury, and it's a yeast-leavening role, and therefore I think we need to be very, very cautious as we take that role upon ourselves, that we make sure that we come to it with clear perspective and rigorous levels or demands of evidence. I want to talk about the papers kind of together. It intrigues me that academicians love to categorize. We may not be able to do anything if we didn't categorize. And so we surely have categorized in these two papers: doctrinal, ecclesiastical, creative and defensive, literalism, and legitimate and shadow authority. So we've legitimized ourselves by getting some categories that we can memorize and use on tests. So I would say then that the two things that are very common in these papers is their approach by categorizing and the role of critic they have in society. I couldn't help but think as I sat here and saw Tom Rogers come in. Recently I was in East Germany, and if I could have had any one of the 4,500 members of the church we have in East Germany sit in this meeting today, it would just absolutely have blown their minds. The problem is that a good portion of the members of my ward might have reacted exactly the same way. Now, I'm terribly moved by Dick Butler's paper because it's an issue that Tom and I and some of you, for example, have spent our lives on. I'm terribly concerned about the Nazi movement, the communist movement in Europe, where the question of authority and authoritarianism and dictatorship and so forth is terribly apparent, and you can't be a Mormon and be involved in those things without seeing some parallels that are just scary. And I think Dick has raised some of those issues. Nonetheless, I think it's terribly important that we look at the thing with perspective. Now, I'd like to suggest some perspectives for Dick. Dick's my honored colleague, senior person, and so I'm doing this out of obligation, Dick. I'm supposed to give the other side, so here it is. Mormons are not committed to believe that the world was created in 7,000 years. Mormons are not committed to sell their homes and get on the roofs to greet the end of the world on a specific date. Mormons are much less millennial than they used to be. Mormons are not officially anti-secular. Mormons have changed their literalness view on Zion and the gathering from what it used to be. One point on the side that I thought Dick should have said, if there's ever anything literal, it's our ideas about the Garden of Eden. He didn't throw that one in, so that's one on your side. Mormons are not lobbying for amendments for prayers in school. Mormons are not lobbying for an abortion amendment, anti-abortion amendment. Mormons are not officially, that is, the church has not taken an official anti-evolution stand. There was a fine article in Dialogue that went through all of the anguish of that one. Now, the point is, there are a lot of people around who are a lot more literal in their religion than Mormons are. And we don't get that from Dick's paper. We get all of the things that are literal. I agree. There's a lot of literalness. But there's a lot of literalness that we're not involved in. Another little interesting comment about Dick's paper. It intrigued me that it was all right for Joseph Smith to be literal, but not for Joseph Fielding Smith. Another point for Dick. He decries the move from John A. Widtsoe to Joseph Fielding Smith and Bruce McConkie, but ignores the fact that Neil Maxwell is taking over. I don't know where Neil's going to be, whether he's in the literal or the figurative camp, and that may not even be the area. But certainly he is a return to the higher education theology that John A. Widtsoe proposed. And the other thing that intrigued me was the great concern about Joseph Fielding Smith's literalness, and yet we ignore the fact that when Joseph Fielding Smith became president of the church, we did not implant the doctrine against evolution. I don't think he said anything about evolution when he was president of the church, the time he had waited all those years to have a chance. I question that the literalness of our interpretation of the first vision was what gave birth to the doctrine of eternal progression or the doctrine of plural marriage. I don't know enough about theology to challenge his point, but a historian is paid to doubt, and I just doubt that that's where those two doctrines emerged. I also doubt, and there are people in the audience who can really help me on this, that Brother Dame's patriarchal blessing was a major factor in the bringing about of the Mountain Meadows Massacre. And so this is an example of what I think is important for us as members of the Academy. We must demand rigorous standards of evidence when we criticize. Now, I believe above all we need to criticize. But boy, we make ourselves vulnerable when we make criticisms that evidence can then undermine. To Dick Butler's paper for a minute. Oh, this is tough to say. I know I've sat in your position and I've sat in their position, and I'm really uptight about authoritarianism. But I'm also a professor of history, and we've got to face the blunt fact that authoritarianism is the major mode of civilization. Most civilizations are authoritarian. If you study the great Egyptian society, if you study the Persian society, much of the Roman society, certainly the medieval society, authoritarianism is the normal mode. Now, we are born and raised in the Enlightenment presuppositions. We're converted to them. We are dogmatically loyal to them. But when we sit down to criticize authority, I think we have a responsibility, because we have the advantage of a great deal of more education than the lay members of the church, to look at it in a balanced form. I think there are some strengths to the authoritarian system, and the only one we heard was efficiency. Now, that's a dirty word. One of the things I think that Dick Butler needs to look at is that there are some geniestic anti-authoritarian devices in the church. There are buffering systems. I have seen mission presidents geniestically buffer their upper echelon leaders' instructions from the members. One of the most interesting things in the whole church, I think, is the office of bishop. The office of bishop has a great deal of discretionary power. And bishops have a marvelous way of interpreting and buffering. Now, the bishop he cited did something he did not like. But I think he also knows of some evidences when bishops gave some downright good advice on birth control, on political campaigns and other things of that nature. I know darn well that the frustration at the authoritarian center down the street here is that they can do a lot of writing and demanding, and then when they go to their own meetings, they see nothing coming out of the end of the pike from what they said was supposed to happen. Bless the bishops. I want to conclude with the important point a very important point that Dick Butler made about standards for using authority. The giant of this earth in my life is a man named Lowell Bunyan, who many of you know, and I recall a lesson he gave us one time in which he said, it was a live issue at the time, someone asked, "Brother Bunyan, what if you were required to teach anti-evolution as doctrine in this classroom at the Institute?" That's a very real possibility. And he said, "All right, this is what I would do, supposing it were to come from Joseph Fielding," because the book was big at the time. "Number one, I would consult the scripture. I would examine as unbiasedly as I could, rather than trying to justify my own position. I would examine the scripture, and then I would pray. Then I would seek the advice of a knowledgeable colleague, someone who was not as emotionally involved in the thing as I. And then I would pray. And then I would seek the advice of my ecclesiastical leader. And then I would pray. And then I would return to my challenger and ask for clarification of what it is that person's view and demand was of me. And then I would pray. And then I would resign." Now, I think that's darn good evidence, darn good process. Because I think he points out that a lot of the mild paranoia of the intellectual community, of which I consider myself a part, could be handled with evidence, dialogue, cool, calm, reasoned consideration. But there still comes a time when principle and authority may clash. But we don't need to necessarily seek it unless the data is absolutely clear. I congratulate these two men for courage, for things that need to be said at this time on tough issues. I encourage that we all, including they and especially me, make sure our standards are very rigorous on these delicate issues.
Thank you for a very challenging response. I just want to say one or two things. One of them is the fact that what I wanted to dramatize by my paper is the fact that what I'm talking about, as far as literalism is concerned, is indeed a mindset. And it's kind of like trying to tell a fish, you know, about water. Fish are in water, but they really aren't quite aware of what it is because they have no basis for comparing it. And I have the feeling many of the Latter-day Saints I've discussed this issue with don't see what I'm driving at. So what? You call it literal-mindedness. Well, that's the truth. I guess the person that I read my paper to who seemed to get the most out of it was not LDS. He's a colleague of mine in the Department of Languages here at the University of Utah, who has been exposed to many returned missionaries from Spanish-speaking missions, who come back and can't get the point of the kind of analysis that he has to engage in trying to get to the basis of the various novels, poems, and plays. Why? Because they come with this literal mindset. And it's interesting to note that it's something that we have some difficulty getting a full grasp of if we can't stand back and look at it. It's just something that's kind of dawned on me more and more. Now, it's true. I'm not really trying to make the case that there is some historical connection between the various points of literalism in Joseph Smith's career and the first vision. I was trying to point out kind of a logical concomitance there, that there is a logical cohesiveness, that given the literal nature in which God manifested himself to Joseph Smith, all the other things, in a certain sense, can be seen to follow. And I'm not trying to make the other claim. Also, the point was rather interesting that you felt that I was not justified in saying that Joseph Smith could be literal and Joseph Fielding Smith couldn't. I'm not saying that. It's just that I have not come across many instances where Joseph Fielding Smith's literalism was creative. I just haven't. I'd like to have that pointed out to me. If there is such a thing, please let me know. And I've read extensively in Joseph Fielding Smith. Also, as far as Dame's testimony is concerned, I should say his patriarchal blessing, I'm doing basically what Juanita Brooks did, and that is simply looking at the evidence. Once you've read that, and once you look at the circumstances, you can't see that they're not connected in some way. And I'm not trying to say that that's exactly why he gave the orders that he did, but there's no doubt but what he was certainly predisposed in that direction. And if anything, it kind of gets him off the hook in a certain sense, and I also wanted to suggest that. So the main point I want to make, and again, I'd like to kind of throw this out as a challenge to anyone who's interested in it, I think that there's much that can be done about literalism and literal-mindedness. I think that it is certainly at least as positive a force in Mormonism as it has been a negative force, and there's much that can be said about it.
Open to questions.
Open to lobbies. St. George.
Played by Martin Clark, which he talked about the ship's testimonies from last year. And I wondered if Dr. Jones could respond with us to see maybe that related to increasing literalness, the fact that people perhaps more often now say, I know the testimony that you guys have talked about, just their thankfulness, or their belief, or their faith, or their hope. Are these things related to the article that you wrote?
I'm not acquainted with that article. Could you just clarify a little bit more?
It's a special article in which he talks about the last in his lifetime, in testimony meetings, there has been a shift in the literalness of the testimony. How they say, I know this is true, there is no doubt, there is not a sliver of
You mean doubt. More emphatically stating it than perhaps was the case earlier, that kind of
earlier
thing?
Earlier testimonies did not have this sense of veracity. There was more a sense of hope, or we believe these things, so they talk about faith. I have faith in the truth.
I wouldn't be...
I don't know about in your own life.
Right. I wouldn't be in a... I think there might be something of a shift of that sort. I think I've always noticed a tendency to want to bring literalness or literal-mindedness to bear on testimonies in an effort to really sound as though one is totally convinced that the gospel is true and all the rest of it. And sometimes it is done so vigorously that you almost suspect that the individual has doubts and is trying to talk him or herself out of those doubts in some way. I've even seen people get up and bear a testimony where they say, in effect, I believe it's true. You believe it's true. It's got to be true, doesn't it? This sort of thing. There's a kind of a desperation in the way in which they come out with that kind of literal-mindedness. And it sounds almost, again, like defensiveness or overkill. And I don't know what to say about any trends that are at work there, but I think that that enters in to that. I don't think that it's all bad or all wrong, but I think it is definitely an element.
I'm immersed in one of your tough questions. I'm in Utah as a missionary for the Equal Rights Amendment, and I have one observation that might be interesting to you. We visited homes in what I would refer to as two categories, the lower-income high school types and the higher-income college types. There's a third category, which interests me most of all, and you people represent it. That's the college category. The thing that's impressed me after 1 week of heavy canvassing is the startling reference to the church as spoken. I usually say, well, there's free agency. The speaking has not been identified as revelation, and some of these kind of things, but there's almost a completely closed mind. The standard procedure is to open the door and say two or three times, we're not interested, maybe not even interested in seeing your literature, goodbye, nicely. But the really painful thing to me as a former BYU lifetime Mormon is that the academic community that ought to really know that God believes men and women are equal are apparently producing almost no spokespeople for statutory equality.
Well, I think this is a good example of the problem that I was trying to get at, and that's distinguishing between editorializing and lobbying and analysis. I think the intellectual community has been very critical of the church over the years because it has not engaged in the social gospel. And people have felt that the church needs to take a stand more on social issues. Then suddenly the intellectuals were stunned when the church took a position on MX. And we went away with nearly tears in our eyes. But others of the same ilk are very, very upset when the church takes a position on a social issue on the conservative side and feels that that is uninspired and the church should get out of politics and on and on. I don't think we're consistent. I think we argue what we want the church to do is to support what we want. And I don't think that's the intellectual process. I think we need to be a little more open-ended. I'm thrilled to death about the MX statement. But the church has a right to take a position on MX, on abortion, and then I'm in trouble.
Simply on the basis of what the intolerant state.
And I think that's his point.
Just flips right around. That troubles me.
I'm sure glad they did. I think we have to be very specific here. The church is involved in ERA. The church is involved in anti-pornography. Now, the church has struggled pro and con for a long time on evolution and has not taken a stand. Various people have taken stands of their own, and they became very, very powerful. But there is a distinction between a doctrinal struggle which they cannot conclude and a policy like ERA. They may do it through a ghost organization, pornography is done through a friend organization, but the church is involved.
Yep. You know what one person said to me is about
and that's and that's the point I want to make. We do not believe it. We do not believe it. There are 500 practicing geneticists and chemists and scientists who are pro-evolution, who are also bishops, stake presidents, and on and on and on.
But
that issue's open.
If you take a Gallup poll, he's right.
That's fine.
That's the world inside the church.
You wanted the closing statement.
Hurry.
Yeah, essentially what he said is to redefine...
I'm informed that we're through. Sorry.